Artistic Director and Co-CEO of London Bubble Theatre. I've worked here for 12 years now and been AD for three. And we are a community theatre organisation that's based in South London, but operates more broadly. And we exist to explore the stories that matter to our communities. So we typically reach people who might not feel arts and culture are for them. So we do a lot of work with older adults, particularly those living in sheltered accommodation. We work with young people in the youth justice system, with care experience, who might be struggling at school. We work with children in primary schools who are at risk of serious youth violence and who have communication needs. So things that we see typically across all of those groups is that they are underserved, underrepresented, and often feel unnoticed, invisible. So a lot of our work is about making those groups feel seen and heard and providing an opportunity for them to express themselves, be creative, and bring the stories that matter to them to the fore.
Cool. Thank you. It sounds as though you have a huge civic responsibility and impact on the community where you're based. How does that practically translate to running the building, creating a space where those sorts of provisions can take place, like applying for funding? How does that practically take shape?
It's really hard. It's something that's a question that we ask ourselves a lot and that our board ask us a lot. And we often, I suppose, in terms of funding, separate those projects into age-specific strands. So we might be applying for funding for our older adults program or our children's program or our young people's program. Or we might be looking, so something that all of the projects have in common is that the theatre we make is often in non-theatre spaces. So we are not a venue, we're not an auditorium. Our building is an old warehouse space just by the River Thames. And some of our projects take place here, but a lot of our projects take place in the community, whether that's in schools or council buildings or housing settings. So in the building itself, I mean, I love it because there are so many people who come through from different walks of life and there's never a dull day here. We have people dropping in quite often. Sometimes that's our young people and they're coming maybe for support with an audition or to work on a CV or they've got a self-tape to do. Sometimes it's very practical life support that they're looking for. Sometimes because we're here in the community and we've been here a long time, one of the things we're most proud of is the longevity of the relationships we create. So our members, our participants can have relationships with us in excess of 10 years. And they very much feel like this is a space that they can come to and have a cup of tea and a chat. And, you know, it might be theatre related, or actually it might not be. It might be that they just need somewhere to be where they feel familiar, where they feel safe to talk about other things. That's something that in our strategy we think makes us really unique, that longevity of relationship. And that, I mean, London Bubble's existed since 1972, so 52 years of reaching the community and engaging the community in theatre is no mean feat, and a lot of that relies on the relationships we build, whether that's with participants or stakeholders or partners.
It's really lovely to see, and the audience won't be able to witness this, but you have so much passion and happiness, like when you're talking about your programs, like you emit from what you're describing, the work that you do, like it's so inspiring and so lovely to see. I wonder, off the back of what you've just described, what do you credit for your success with engaging communities? Like, is there any critical learning that you could share in relation to a theatre or a program who are aiming to create successful community cohesion?
I think it's about meeting people where they are. So making those, it might be that sessions need to take place in spaces that people are already familiar with and don't find intimidating. I think in terms of making, I mean, all our activity is free to those who take part. So we're making sure that finance is not a barrier. We offer refreshments on most projects. For some people, that might be lunch. For some people, that might be, you know, drinks and snacks, depending on the project. But those things make a huge difference. For our 18 to 25s, we reimburse travel for the Young Theatre Makers Programme. And, you know, people tell us that really makes a difference. If it doesn't cost them to be here and they know they'll get fed, that makes it really something that they can rely on. And, you know, we have seen that people rely on the food that they get here, and that that might be the only meal that they can guarantee they're having that day, which, you know, just brings an extra layer to what it means to be working in the community. So we're based where we are in the London Borough of Southwark. We are the London Borough that has the most theatre and arts and culture venues in it. So, like, we've got massive, you know, cultural institutions, world-renowned places on our doorstep here: the National, the Tate, the Young Vic, the Old Vic, and that, you know, they're in walking distance from us. But a lot of our members who live in this borough have never set foot inside those places. So I think we see ourselves as a little bit of a gateway to arts and culture, that maybe we're able to meet people and provide things that feel accessible, that feel unintimidating. But once members get to know us, we might be able to take them to some of those institutions. We might go see a show, we might go see an exhibition. And we're really, that, like, part of the purpose of the project is about increasing that cultural capital. So we talk a lot about social and emotional well-being and social and emotional skills as being key outcomes from our projects, but also cultural capital.
Okay, right. That's left me with a lot of questions. Okay.
Go for it.
So, talk me through your current list of programmes and projects, if that's okay.
Yeah. So, for children, we run Speech Bubbles, which is a communication intervention that happens for Key Stage 1 children with speech, language and communication needs. So we currently deliver that in 5 schools locally. 3 of them are SCND schools. And that's about encouraging social skills as well as storytelling skills. It's based in storytelling and story play, and about children who might struggle to process information, to speak, to communicate in a range of ways, to be able to organise a story structure, tell stories, play and act out stories, and the impact on their classroom learning and their literacy skills is massive. Playing Safe is a project for Year 6 children. It's an intervention against serious youth violence. So it happens in our borough, where unfortunately serious youth violence is a massive issue. And the premise of the project is that it intervenes early to engage those young people at risk before they leave primary school, before they go to secondary school, before that long summer where they've got, you know, they've been the big kids, and before they go to be a small fish in a big pond, where they're particularly vulnerable, to consider grooming, to consider safety, to consider choices, to consider what they want and who they are. As we know that once those skills are developed, you're far less susceptible or vulnerable to exploitation. In our young people's programme, we have a partnership with Southwark Children and Family Services. So we deliver several projects a year within Southwark's Youth Justice Service. We also work with Speakerbox, which is the Children in Care Council in this borough. And some of that work's been replicated in other London boroughs as well. And those projects are all about young people making a play. So it might be over a week, it might be over 6 weeks, depending who and where we are. But that's about starting with nothing and saying we're here to tell the story that is important to you. And your voice and your ideas are going to drive this. So one of our most common starting points is a pair of trainers. So we often use shoes as a stimulus, and we'll start by co-designing, co-creating a character and telling that person's story, which may or may not reflect the real experiences, the lived experiences in the room. Something that we would never do is say this play has to be about crime or this play has to be about care. But often those references appear because they're what's known by the group. And then in our Young Theatre Makers programme is for 18 to 25s. And that's based in techniques from Theatre of the Oppressed. They devise a piece of forum theatre. They consult other young people in the community about the most pressing issues and devise a piece that they really care about that reflects the disempowerment that young people face. And they tour it. They go to secondary schools, youth settings, some universities and higher education settings, and gain not only performance and devising experience, but leadership experience as well. Following their tour, we offer them work experience on another bubble project, and they have the opportunity, and the plan is that they become our workforce moving forward. So currently, of our freelance workforce, 50% of them have been through our Young Theatre Makers programme. So we're incredibly proud of that homegrown talent. And, you know, they're changing the face, not just of London Bubble, but the sector, because they go on to work in other places. And really, I really value employing people who have been members, who understand our process, who have experienced it, and therefore can share that experience with more people in the community. And we see members respond and relate really well to those people, because most of the time they look and sound like them. And then our older adults, we have a Tea Break Theatre, which is a project that happens weekly. It's relaxed, gentle, social theatre making for over 55s. It involves a cup of tea. It involves quite a social element. And then they might be devising something performative. They might be working on specific techniques. We've got one group looking at puppetry at the moment. And we've got another group devising work. I think it's about holidays. So something that they've highlighted as really important to them. And again, there are members of that programme who've been coming for 10 years. And it's a real highlight of their week, I suppose, something that they look forward to. And these are people who maybe didn't try anything creative until this project became available to them in retirement, in later life. So it's really special to see people find their creativity, whether that's through improvisation or writing. Their skills are really broad, and they're so open, really open to learning and playing, and they talk very passionately about how it impacts their well-being. That's great. Then we have the Rotherhithe Shed, which is inspired by the Men's Shed movement. So in our building we have a workshop, a fully operational workshop from when we were a producing touring theatre company, and we open the doors to the workshop twice a week, and older men predominantly, although it is open to women as well, bring in projects and they build things, make things, fix things, paint things, design things, and it's a really wonderful community of older men who come together and share skills with each other actually. So sometimes people bring a project that they don't know how to kind of, you know, realise, and someone else will be like, oh, well, you know, I've got these skills, and it might be that they were tradesmen, or it might be that this has always been a hobby. Yeah, like in some parts of the world, people have that shed at the bottom of the garden to go and tinker in. We have a communal shed here at London Bubble, which...
Wow. How much do you do? What?
Lastly, in our older adults program, and we have a touring company, so a company of older adults who've come together because they want to make theatre and perform it, and they've devised a play which has been performed in sheltered housing, in care homes, and this week we're doing it in a theatre and also at the Performance Studies International Conference. So it's been really interesting actually for me. I've directed the show and worked with the group, to work with a group of older adults who came into the room and we'd had nothing, and I couldn't tell them what the play was going to be, I couldn't tell them what it was called, I couldn't tell them what it was going to be about, and I couldn't tell them who they were going to play or what they were going to say. All I could tell them was that we were going to collaborate and work that out together. And I think maybe for young people, that's really exciting because they're used to being told what to do a lot. So that kind of freedom feels really empowering. For older adults, I think that was quite anxiety inducing, that there were no answers. And they wanted to know on day one who they were playing and where they were going to stand and what they were going to say. So it was quite a new process for this particular group to devise and collaborate. But I think what they've come up with is absolutely incredible. And the story, the characters, the things that they're raising and talking about, I think it's been an experience that's hopefully like giving them confidence and a renewed sense of self-belief and that they can be creative and have interesting things to say.
Marie, like this all sounds so special. Like firstly, first recruitment, right? Like how do you go about recruiting artists, freelancers, theatre staff? Everything that you've described is so rooted in the lives of real people and impacting real lives. Yeah. How do you go about finding the right staff?
Not only do we want to work with really skilled theatre artists, we want to work with people who understand and care about humans. We do meet vulnerable people quite often, and people that there are lots of additional support requirements involved in this work. For me personally, after being here kind of 4 or 5 years, I started to get really interested in wellbeing and therapy. And I worked with the Institute for Arts and Therapy and Education and did the therapeutic wellbeing practice course, because I started to recognize that when you're working with disempowered groups and often exploring themes of disempowerment, although this is very clearly not drama therapy, that we do need a degree of therapeutic understanding to be able to hold it in a responsible way. So we are definitely interested in practitioners who share those values and are willing to undergo trauma-informed practice training, maybe mental health first aid training, to explore different elements of well-being in the community. Sometimes that's age-specific, sometimes that's related to other protective characteristics. But yeah, people who are genuinely interested, I think, in people and humans and stories, because that essentially is what we have to work with.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. And I think as my producing career has evolved, I rely so heavily, and the program relies so heavily on the staff who have the further training in relation to trauma-informed practice, creative arts therapists, like, because the young people that we see, they see us on a Monday and then they may not see any of the support staff until the following session, right? So we're kind of like this really weird, strange go-between service that isn't a service, it's a provision. And I don't think I ever truly understood the impact of the work until now.
Well, because they trust us and they like us, and because of what we've done, we somehow become more approachable than those more clinical services. So lots of the people we engage also have clinical support, but that feels that's different. Here you can talk freely. It's a non-judgmental space. People are very supportive of each other's needs and problems. So yeah, there is that sort of indirect therapeutic output for sure. We for a few years now have been offering therapeutic support to our practitioners, because we recognize how much you can't just switch off at the end of a session. If you really care, you hold it and you wake up thinking about your members and what they've told you in the night. And so yeah, we work with therapists now to offer reflective practice at the end of each term for practitioners, just so that practitioners can process the impact the work has on them personally, which is really interesting. So, but sorry, back to recruitment. Mixture of ways. Sometimes people come to us because they've heard about us and they've got a specialism and they want to engage with us. Every so often we'll hold a sort of open call out where we might invite practitioners to bring an exercise to share and to have a bit of a chat. I think it's really important to see people in practice. I I would always rather employ somebody who I've seen work than just read a CV. We would usually, if someone is quite new to us, we might offer them a support role before a lead artist role, not because we don't think they're capable, but so that they can become familiarized with some of our processes and ways of working, particularly if it's a group that's been long running and the participants have some level of expectation. We staff things quite heavily, so we'll always have a lead artist, a support artist. Lots of groups will also have access support worker who might be doing one-to-one work or just having eyes on a couple of participants who require additional support. We might have one of our young theatre makers on placement, so shadowing and learning on the job. And for a lot of our young people's work, we would employ a lot of those young theatre makers. So if we're working with teenagers, we'd employ people from our 18 to 30s network who sort of act as near peers. And particularly when we're in groups that haven't necessarily chosen to do drama. For example, within the youth justice system, we've kind of developed a model where there might be four near peers. So young men usually, but young men and women in their early 20s, who then might act out the ideas they're being talked about, who might bring it onto his feet and make kind of getting up and doing feel a little bit more accessible. We definitely, sometimes we call it directing from the inside, that our practitioners do what we ask our young people to do as well, and that the bubble team would be very practical and hands-on. Anyone in the room has to take part, always, that's a rule.
Hey, that's great, and what a wonderful model, this organic like rolling staff team. Like, it must be so rewarding seeing them now working in the room. And how do you find reflecting on that journey? Like, do you ever have conversations with them about...
All the time.
Yeah. Does it not trip you out? Together?
Yeah, particularly if they're people that I worked with when they were 18 and, you know, then they're turning 30 and they're reflecting on the fact that we're friends and colleagues now. That's quite a journey. They often reflect on that. So that we've been constant and continuous. They might have gone away and done something else. They might have gone and trained. They might have gone and worked somewhere else. They might have tried another career, but that there's something that they can come back to. And there are staff now working on every project. So delivering for older adults, delivering for children, delivering for young people, who never would have imagined that would be their journey when they signed up to a 3-month programme as a 19-year-old. And it's really special. It makes me really proud.
Did you think that it would be part of their journey at like 18, 19 years old?
Some of them, yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes, like, it's a career you don't know about when you're 18 or 19. Everybody knows about being an actor because it's a bit we see. And you must hear this all the time. Like, people haven't really considered being a practitioner. And there is a moment where sometimes people have turned around and said, Maria, I want to do what you do. Or they want to know more. They get curious. And some people just demonstrate those skills, like they radiate those skills. So it's quite clear that they're engaging people who have influence, who listen, who are creative, who care. Some people, it's very clear that that's where they're going to be. Whether they're going to enjoy it or not is a different thing. But I think we're quite good at seeing who's got those skills and who, and the interest, because obviously the skills are nothing without the passion.
So lastly, just to ask in relation to your programming, how do you go about ensuring that you have the correct boundaries in place when working with the client groups and the communities that you do? Because I don't think until I started producing the Plus One program specifically that I really had as much experience as running a provision that can get misconstrued as a service. And it's something that is really, really tough, because not only are you having to be wary of that and hold and put boundaries in place for the participants, but also you're having to align those boundaries with the staff that you employ as well, because also they bring a whole wealth of experience too. Like, how do you go about doing that so successfully? How do you manage not becoming more than what your offer is, I guess?
Yeah, it's something we have to, like, you know, ask ourselves and check in on quite often, and remind ourselves that we're a theatre company first and that we're not social care. Luckily, because we know social care locally quite well, we've got lots of referral points that we can draw on if necessary. And when people are referred to us, we're quite clear around who holds the relationship with young people. So often we won't have kind of contact details or particularly if we're working in partnership with statutory services for those young people, we turn up to deliver the programme. And I mean, it can be quite hard to say no when because often you do care implicitly. So you want to support people. And it's an ongoing conversation that we have with the team. There are, you know, people do ask us to do things that are way beyond our role. And sometimes we have to be really clear and say, I'm really sorry, I can't do that. That's not my job. And sometimes it's things where, it's really interesting with older adults, particularly when we've worked in sheltered housing, where people have come down to the space for the drama workshop with their nail clippers and said, can you clip my nails? And they're doing that because they trust you and because they see you as someone who can, you know, be that person. And you know in your heart that would take 2 minutes and that's not a big issue, I could do that. But that's a really hard thing to say no to, because once that kind of, I mean, we're not there to offer personal care, and once that starts, who knows what the next request might be. So we come across those little things a lot, and we have people here with medical conditions, which mean that sometimes like first aid or like calling for an ambulance and those things, like, we there is a bit of a murky line. There's somebody here who I know far too much about their medical history because of the support we've given them when they've been taken ill here. And there are young people here who are vulnerable and often don't have another trusted adult. So I think there's also like a decision call, and what we would encourage in the team is openness and transparency. Like, if we really believe that any person who can help them make that call, or, you know, if it needs to be done, that sometimes those things do need to be done, but that we would ask that that's recorded, spoken about for safeguarding purposes, and not so that one person's not doing something on their own that's making them vulnerable in turn. It's interesting as well with services, and because we get commissioned to do a lot of things, and we might get commissioned to do a drama project that goes well, that then somebody else the same organisation might want us to do another kind of project and get upset when we say, but that's not theatre and we're a theatre project. So we wish you very all the best for that project. We can't coordinate that and we can't deliver that because that's not actually our remit. And you know, they want to give us work and that, but yeah, like holding like who we are and what's at our core is really important. So yeah, two sets of boundaries that we have to be mindful of: those kind of personal relationships with members, and relationships with partners and other services who want to work with us in lots of different ways. And you know, if they're paying, it's really hard sometimes to say no to that thing that's not really what we do, but we could do it.
Yeah, it's really tough. And when, especially from your perspective as well, like when you're so rooted in people's lives, like, I don't know whether it is fair to say, but we are constantly like tightroping it, like pushing, redefining boundaries. Yeah. Would you agree?
Yeah. And I think that the more work we do, particularly I'm thinking about in children's and family services now. So we've worked with children, we've worked with parents groups where, you know, their children might have been removed, or for whatever reason that the family is known within children and family services. And all of this information, like, and the work in schools, it all feeds into each other, and our understanding of the system and our understanding of the experience that children and families are going through. And at the end of the day, that does help us make better theatre. So, for example, this earlier this year, we were commissioned to make a play that was about how families from the global majority might have experienced social care, or how they might, how their race or culture might have impacted their experience of social care. So we worked with a steering group of parents. They shared some stories. Our actors developed it into a play, and it was shown as part of a wider session for parents with and staff within social services. And that stuff is really impactful. Like, we had I will never forget the lady on the front row who just sat and cried her eyes out all the way through and said, "That was my story. You just showed what happened to me, and thank you for showing that that's not okay." And like, so all of the work that we do feeds into making the theatre we make better, I think, and making it more nuanced and making it more accurate. We're also in partnership at the moment with the Museum of London, and we've made a show which is touring to schools in every London borough over the next 3 years. And it's about identity and belonging for young people in London and what representation looks like in museums. And as part of that story, one of the characters we've created is a looked after child. And we've been able to include that care experience because of the work we do with young people who are in care or have been in care, and make a character that feels representative of what those children experience. And we took that into a school earlier this year, and a little girl had her hand up and she was looking at me, and her comment was, "That character's in foster care." And we're like, "Oh yeah, she is." And she mouthed to me, "I'm in foster care." And like, it was just, her face was lit up, and I just thought, where she doesn't see her life included as the norm. Like, this play is not about foster care being good or bad. It just so happens that one of the characters lives with people who are not her birth parents. And yeah, for that little girl in that school, that was, I mean, I found it very moving and very powerful to see her see herself and feel proud. And you know, feel that she wanted to talk about that experience and claim it. Yeah. So yeah, I can't remember what your question was now. I'm sorry, I'm just talking. But all of the work feeds in to each other and informs the next project in some way.
Marie, I will be super intrigued to know what leads your decision-making in relation to new projects, what you're going to produce next.
Yeah.
How do you go about navigating that and making those decisions?
Yeah.
Like, is it always... because you've always got to consider things, existing things that you've got, right? So how do you go about going, right, this is what we do next, this is the direction we move in?
I mean, there are things that we want to deliver. There are things that we want to produce ourselves. Obviously, we always have to find the funding to make those happen. So often when we're approached by other people, we'll compare the project to our values, our ethos, our aims for the kind of next few years, and see if they're a good fit for our commitments. And if they are, then great. It's really nice to be asked to do things. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we really want to develop over the next couple of years is a big community performance. So something site specific with community actors about the things that matter to them. So yeah, something that's intergenerational, that's not so tightly bounded by age.
What, like big ensemble, like big community company?
Big ensemble, probably place-based.
Okay, how exciting. Okay. Right, you have a show and a tour coming up. Talk to me about that. Tell me, please.
Yeah, so this is the older adult company, and they came together to devise a piece. We had 4 weeks, which actually is only 8 afternoons, to make this show. Not a lot of time at all. It's about Archie is a retired racing car driver, and he's a hoarder, and he's lonely. He lives in a house, he doesn't really come out, doesn't really interact with the community anymore, and they don't don't really interact with him anymore. He's short-tempered with his daughter. And that was an idea that came up really early on, that he was a hoarder. And then we started to really like think about, but who is he and why and what's he hoarding and what's the reason? And the story that the group developed is that his wife disappeared 18 years ago, mysteriously disappeared. So he's been keeping newspapers ever since and trying to find reference to her in the newspapers. And then he goes on a journey to try and find her. And it's a reflective journey. We see his life with his wife from 1973 to 2006 when she disappears. And we see their relationship played out. And he has to reflect on a few truths about what happened in the relationship. It's deeply emotional. And again, when we started this process, we didn't say this was going to be a play about aging or age. But inevitably, we made a character in their 70s and then looked at all the things that have kind of happened in their adult life. And it's a really beautiful story, actually. And the nuances of a relationships between husband and wife and between parent and child, when it's an adult child, when responsibility starts to shift, that's come up. And I suppose, like, indirectly, we've been looking at male mental health and, you know, that generation of older men who don't talk about feelings.
Yeah, that really came up for me. It's really funny that you say that, because after I watched it,
you watched it?
Yes, okay. I did. Yeah, of course. And honestly, I really, really enjoyed it. It was a really great piece of work. And it was really quite hard hitting, actually, as for lots of different reasons. And I went to make a drink after watching it. And as I thought about it through my own personal experiences growing up, my own relationship and my parents' relationship, and then also friends and their fathers and marriages and separation, like, what the show did so well was paint a picture of both an individual's journey through unaddressed grief or unanswered grief, and then the impact that that then has on the lives of people around you, even from a stranger's point of view, of trying to work out who you are as a person and how that unaddressed grief manifests itself into the world to a point, and the point in the play where the character or you as an individual are going to have to deal with that. And it was really, really powerful, Marie. It was a really great piece and a real credit to those performers, because they told such a brilliant story. It was ace.
Yeah. And I think everyone can relate to that, regardless of that. It doesn't have to be about people leaving a relationship that's ending. That there's an element of that, isn't there? That, you know, what we show and what we keep inside and what we let. Yeah. I think so the two shows that we've had this week, both days, and there've been women sat on the front row in floods of tears. And yeah, I don't know that we were expecting how emotional people would find it. And it's that scene with the wives where it shifts and they find it very emotional. And we've been talking a lot about that with the company. Like, it's actually a really special thing to perform so close to your audience that you can see those tears and then have a chat with them afterwards. And I think it's something that gets overlooked in community theatre, that, you know, there's so much that, oh, but it's not real theatre because it's in a care home, or it's not real theatre because it's in a school. But it's better because the connection is so much more urgent and intimate. I think there's something very validating as performers to see the impact you're having 2 meters in front of you on people, and then sit and have a cup of tea with them afterwards and talk about it.
And I think for, like, your facilitators as well, or facilitators generally, I think that experiencing a truly professional TIE gig within your career really enlightens you to a very similar insight as to how an intimate topic or a topic-led performance really engages and provokes an audience. How do the audience and the actors relate during the experience of the show? Because there must be some, or is there, like a blurring of shared life experience, right? Like, how does that play out?
Yeah, and I think there's a connection that's formed over that. So typically I go on stage at the end and facilitate a bit of a conversation, and we just have a bit of a chat, and I might ask, did you enjoy it? Was it realistic? And was it realistic is often the floodgate to, yes, this is happening to people every single day, or that bit where that happened, that was, and yeah, that that realistic thing really chimes with the audience. And I think, yeah, the actors, they enjoy, they find that very validating, that the story that they've made is being received so well. And, you know, they'll have like one of the great debates that we have at the end of this play is where did Mabel go? Where is she? And it ranges from people like, oh, she's living in Las Vegas. She's got a new husband. She's found a new life. She's started again. And there's people who are like, oh no, she's around the corner and she's still in touch with her children. Or yesterday we had someone, no, she would never let that trauma, like she would never let Archie and the children go through that trauma. If she's alive, she would tell them, she wouldn't want them to be hurting. And you know, they're really invested, they really care, they've got opinions about where Mabel is or why she left or whether, you know.
And generationally, in terms of marriage and companionship.
Yeah. And leaving children, I think the fact that, you know, the story suggests that she left her children, like women in the audience who are, you know, aged 60 plus, I find that very hard. And like, we all know it happens, but women who are mothers who can't imagine doing that have quite a strong reaction.
Do you think the cast were ready for the weight of the piece?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, and when it started and we were like, oh yeah, she's disappeared, and like we'd kind of played around with it for a week, and then I was like, but we actually, as a team, we have to know what happened. Like, was she abducted by aliens, or has she died, or like, and it took us quite a while to really work that out, and like in terms of the style of the piece as well, because I think at one point they were quite keen that it was a comedy and it was funny and there are funny elements, but actually, no, I don't think any of us really knew that it was going to be so evocative.
So what's next with that piece of work? Where now with that program?
Well, this is the second tour. So we originally made it in November, and somebody came to see it in November and said, please apply to perform this at the Performance Studies International Conference, which we did, and we were accepted. So that's on Friday, and we built this week to kind of like, well, if we're bringing it back, we'll bring it back properly. So three housing settings, one public performance in a theatre, and one at a conference. So that feels, it feels like a really complete thing now. And I have been amazed how much the cast remembered. We've had four rehearsals before this revamp, and they were straight back in. I thought, well, we might have to change that, or they might, but you know, we got through it really quickly, and they remembered, and they were ready, and they were excited to be back. A few little improvements, but not many. And I think this might be the end for this project. I think we've got to see what's next now. And hopefully, I mean, obviously, it all comes down to funding. As always, we don't have funding for an older adult company next year. Hopefully, we will get that, and hopefully, it'll be a new company, and they'll make a new story.
Well, a huge congratulations to all of the company and yourself and all of the creatives that made it.
Oh yeah, well, feels it already. It feels exciting.
Honestly, it was a really, really great piece of theatre. I really enjoyed it, and hopefully, its digital legacy continues to reach audiences, and I will be, I will share that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and it will be on the website again after this week. So people can see it on the website. I think it's an interesting example of devising work with older adults who are not necessarily used to doing that. And, you know, multi-rolling techniques that young people are familiar with because they do it in school drama, that have been quite new and exciting for older people.
I think the mixture of where it is that you work and the work that you and your teams do, it sounds so special, Marie. Honestly, like, just sitting and listening to everything that you're doing massively strikes a chord and resonates, because I'm involved with lots of similar things, and like, you're doing it on such a huge scale as a venue, as a building. Honestly, it's so lovely to hear it. It's really special.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously you're doing it in the department, you know, it's a department in a theatre, whereas, and I'm not sure if it's a luxury or a, I think it's a luxury that that's our entire kind of bread and bones. We are a participation department or a community department with a bit of professional theatre on the side, as opposed to a professional theatre with a department within it. And it's exciting and it's special, but it means we sometimes get overlooked because we don't have that reputational pull of a producing house.
Yeah, that must be really difficult. And I hope that our conversation today only further shines a light on the incredible work that your organisation and teams are doing. So Maria, massive, massive thank you, honestly, for your time. I really value it. Thank you for talking me through so thoroughly all of the wonderful, wonderful things
that
yourself and London Bubble are up to. Thank you.
Same. And if you're ever in London, please come visit us.
It's a lovely invitation. Thank you very much. Yes, I will. I definitely will. Thank you. I will include all of the theatre's links in the bio. Please, please make sure that you go and check out London Bubble's website and support their work. Thank you, Marie.
Thank you so much.
Bye. See you.